Okay, so I'm going to talk about David Lloyd and Bhikkhu Bodhi. I'm going to start with David Lloyd. Now, he's quite unusual because he's a practicing Buddhist and he's also an academic. There are a few of these around, actual academics who write about Buddhism as academics but are also practicing Buddhists. He's been a Zen practitioner since 1971, and he's a qualified Zen teacher. And he spent quite a bit of his adult life living in the East. He lived for 6 years in Singapore and 15 years in Japan. I think that's something that's common between Bante and Bhikkhu Bodhi and David Lloyd, is that they all have spent significant periods of time in the East as well as in the West. So my first contact with David Lloyd was reading a book called A Buddhist History of the West. And this is a book that examines how greed, hatred and delusion have conditioned the history of the West. So he's written a history of the West using, if you like, a Buddhist lens to examine and talk about that history. And it really excited me, the book. I really liked it because I liked the grand scale and the perspective of the project. You know, what a magnificent idea to look at the history of the West, key events in the West, from a Buddhist perspective. And it reminded me of something of what I felt when I got involved in Tri Ratna and got connected with Tri Ratna. One of the main reasons for that was because Sangharakshita talked about the axial age, that period from 800 to 200 BCE, when there were all these new thinkers arising, including the Buddha. He talked about evolution. He had a grand view of history and time. And that excites me. And something about David Lloyd's book, A Buddhist History of the West, excited me in the same way. What's central to that book is his notion of what he calls lack. L-A-C-K, his notion of lack. So I want to try and just unpick that, what this notion is. So Buddhism teaches us that there is no fixed and separate self. There is no fixed and separate self. Our sense of self, if you like, is constructed. It's an ever-changing process. There's no fixed, unchanging, separate essence to it. It's an ever-changing process. The self does not exist separately, does not exist in its own right. And because of the absence of a separate reality of its own, because of the absence of any fixed or permanent or stable ground, then the self, David Lloyd argues, is haunted at some level by a sense of lack, that something is missing. That fact that we don't have any stable or permanent ground, at some level we know that. We are haunted by a sense of lack, or lack for short. But because of our inability to recognize and accept fully that the self is empty of a separate and fixed existence, we close up and experience a deep-rooted level of unease or unsatisfactoriness or suffering which we can never quite resolve. So that we have this sense of lack. There's a sense that something is missing. We close up and don't quite engage with it. And the result is that there, at a deep level, there is, if you like, an existential level of suffering, of unsatisfactoriness, of unease. And one of the ways that we use to try to cover up this sense of lack, to cover up the fact that the sense, that the self has no fixed or permanent separate existence, One of the ways that we use to cover that up is consumerism. And consumerism promises but never can ultimately deliver fulfillment. We are deceived into seeking an answer to this sense of lack through consumerism. We are fooled into going down that path. So we try to build a sense of identity by consuming. And as David Loy says, if instead we were to explore this lack of a separate fixed existence and even to embrace it, we would in fact discover a tremendous source of creativity and positivity. We may be scared and put off the idea of exploring it, but in fact, if we were to embrace the reality that there is no separate fixed self existence, we would discover a tremendous source of creativity and positivity. But we're fooled. So this sense of lack, this lack is what is right the way through the book, The Buddhist History of the West. And it's a central part of his take of what is wrong with our lives and with our society. So just pause there. Any question on that? Because this is quite a fundamental part of his take. Are we okay with that? All right. So after I read A Buddhist History of the West, I read more of his books. He's a social activist. He's probably the most prominent Buddhist social activist that I know. He participates in an organization in the United States called the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, which is a very socially active organization. They have a Facebook page as well, which is interesting. And he's been involved in the International Network of Engaged Buddhists. He writes blogs. He has occasional articles in the Huffington Post, you know, the internet newspaper, if you come across that. He writes regularly in all sorts of Buddhist magazines. He's a very well-known figure, particularly in America, in Tricycle Magazine, in Buddha Dharma, in Shambhala Sun, and so on. And he regularly pops up on Facebook. He's always raising social issues and urging responses on Facebook. And probably his most accessible book, apart from The Buddhist History of the West, one that is the most contemporary, is a book entitled Money, Sex, War, Karma, Notes for a Buddhist Revolution. It's a really good, sensational title. Money, Sex, War, Karma, Notes for a Buddhist Revolution. And this book brings together essays written by him, some of his most important thinking on socioeconomic topics. And some fascinating things in there on both the West and the East. Because he's lived in the East, he writes some very perceptive critical articles, for example, about the use of karma to restrict women's rights in Thailand and so on. How karma is, the notion of karma is misused. It's a really good book. I can't recommend it too much to you. It's an excellent book. And one of the distinctive contributions in this book is his focus on what he calls the institutionalization of the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion in our modern economic society. He talks a lot about the institutionalization of greed, hatred, and delusion. So, in Buddhism, greed, hatred, and delusion are seen as root poisons. The Buddha talked about them as root poisons. This is what we are born with. We are born with the potential or the tendency for greed and hatred and delusion. They're inherent in being an individual human being. But, of course, we have countervailing potentials of generosity, loving kindness, compassion, and wisdom. So these poisons can be overcome by a path of practice. The Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path, for example, lays down a path of practice that helps us to cultivate generosity, loving kindness, compassion, wisdom, and to counter these tendencies for greed, hatred, and delusion, so that we can turn ourselves into enlightened beings. This relates actually to the idea of there being no fixed, separate, permanent self. If there was a fixed, permanent self, enlightenment would not be possible. It's because there is no fixed and permanent and separate self that enlightenment is possible. So in this way, we can transform greed into its opposite of generosity, hatred into its opposite of loving kindness, and delusion into wisdom. That's basic Buddhism, if you like. But Loy's distinctive contribution, I think, in the book Money, Sex, War, Karma, is to talk about that these three poisons also operate collectively, such that our present economic system institutionalizes greed, militarism, the military-industrial complex, institutionalizes hatred, and our corporate media institutionalize delusion. Yeah. So the present economic system institutionalizes greed. Militarism institutionalizes hatred. And the corporate media, newspapers, television, and so on, institutionalize delusion. So that's a broad analysis. I want to focus in particular on the role that David Loy sees in all this of corporations. Again, he has a very distinctive take on corporations. He says, the institutionalization of greed in our economic system works in two ways. The first is that corporations are never profitable enough. Corporations feel the need always to grow to gain more profits. It's built into the nature of a corporation. Karl Marx wrote this very perceptively in the 19th century about what he saw about, if you like, the embryonic forms of corporation. He had this phrase, accumulate, accumulate, grow, grow. This is the Moses and prophets. In other words, what he saw was there's something built in. There's an instinctive drive to grow, to get ever more profits. And this is what can be the driving motor or the driving force of a corporation. Now that's one side of it. And the other side of the institutionalization of greed works in the way because that people can never consume enough. People can never consume enough. And in the book I quote, there's three particular quotes that I give in the book. From one is from Charles Handy, who was a top Western business guru in the 20th century. He used to appear a lot on the Today program, on the Thought for Day. Very interesting. He's a Christian, as well as being a business guru. He's quite old now. He's just published a book on capitalism, actually, called The Second Curve, which is in his analysis of capitalism. But he was always very good on Thought for the Day, a very thoughtful presenter. But he had this phrase, analysis, which is that economic growth depends upon more and more people wanting more and more of more and more goods and services. So the whole basis of capitalist economic growth requires more and more people to want more and more of more and more goods and services. It's, if you like, it's a definition of capitalism. It's quite an extraordinary definition. And then there's a phrase by Tim Jackson, who I mentioned yesterday, the author of Prosperity Without Growth. And this is actually from a TED talk that he gave, where he said, he's talking about the story of our economic system. And he says, like, the story depends on people like us buying things that we don't need with money that we don't have to make impressions upon people that we don't care about that don't last. Something like that. I might have got the phrasing a bit wrong. But it's something like, depends on us wanting and buying more and more things with using money that we don't have to make impressions upon people that don't last, and impressions upon people that we don't care about. It's quite a sobering analysis. He's actually saying this is the role that we play. Whether we like it or not, we play a part in perpetuating the system. And then the third quote is by an economist who's not very well known now, but in the 1960s he was a maverick economist, a man called E.J. Michan. And he wrote a book on economic growth in the 1960s, which in many ways foresaw all of the problems that we have now. And he said that our system depends upon sustained discontent. Our system depends upon sustained discontent. That we must be made to feel that we don't have enough and we need more consumer goods. So the drive for profits means that people must be conditioned into finding meaning in life through buying and consuming more and more things. And at the same time, when you look at the stock markets, Wall Street, the London Stock Exchange, and so on, what you see there now, particularly now, is that investors demand higher share prices so that their property, their portfolio, is worth more. They demand increased earnings so that shares, once a year or more often, you get dividends, you get a payment, an interest payment, if you like, depending on how well the company is doing. So investors demand more and more earnings or dividends and higher share prices. So that means that the people who run these big corporations, the executives, are in this constant search for higher profits, for more growth, and higher share prices. Maybe even engaging in all sorts of manipulation to drive the share prices up. And very much these days with an emphasis on the short run, short-termism, how you actually can achieve this quickly. This is very much a part of current capitalism. It used to be, I can't remember the exact figures, but it used to be that when people bought shares, they held on to them for years. And I think I read somewhere now the average length of time that people hold on to shares now is something like 8 or 9 months. Something much, much shorter. In other words, the short-term desire for quick gain is quite rampant. So you've got this drive for immediate profitability, higher share prices, more growth, and this is the engine of the world economy. And everything else, including the environment and the quality of life, is subordinate to this demand for profits and growth. David Loy says when it's an anonymous demand for profits and growth. And he says the demand is anonymous because the system has attained a life of its own. It's not that there are individuals who are directing the system. The system has a life of its own. And we all participate in this system, in this process, as workers or as employers, or as consumers, or as investors, or as, in my case, a pensioner. So I have two small occupational pensions. And the money that is used to pay my pension comes from the earnings on the stocks and shares that are the investment of the pension organisation. So in the past, I used to run around calling for the downfall of capitalism. Now, I run around saying, calling for the downfall of capitalism, except please not my shares, the pension that pay my pension. So I'm hooked, aren't I? I'm locked in as a pensioner. In one way or another, we're locked into these systems, so we all play a part in it. And he says that what this means then is that there is a very diffuse sense of moral responsibility. It makes it harder to focus on a particular area. It's easy to blame bankers, and maybe to some extent we should blame bankers and others for the last economic crisis and so on. But it's not enough. We actually have to look at the system and see how we all play a part. And he has a very interesting comment about Occupy Wall Street, David Lloyd. He says that Wall Street is the most concentrated and visible part of a much larger nightmare. And that is the collective delusion that there is no alternative to our present economic system. The collective delusion that there is no alternative to our present economic system. So let's take a look at what he says about corporations. I think this is really interesting. Basically, corporations have been at the heart of the growth and development of capitalism since the middle of the 19th century. What happened in the UK at that time, or before the middle of the 19th century, the situation was that if you as an investor put some money into a company and then that company went bankrupt, you were liable for the debts of that company down to every single thing that you owned. So that if you invested in a company and it went bust, you might lose everything that you had. And the big change that came about in the UK and the USA and other countries was that laws were implemented that said when you invested money in a company, you say you bought shares in a company, that amount of money that you put in there was the limit of your financial responsibility. That you would not lose any more money if it went bust than what you had put in. So this meant that people were free, much freer then, to take risks and invest in companies. So you had these joint stock companies that mushroomed in the UK and in the USA. Massive growth. And they became the corporations that we know today. And David Loy, he's looking at the United States, but similar things apply in the UK. He says there's two particular aspects of the history of the corporation that are very important. One is that corporations were given, if you like, the same status of an individual. They were seen to be individuals in their own right. So they could make decisions, they could go to court, they could do this, that, and the other. So a corporation could take action as an individual and be treated legally as an individual. And the second big thing that happened historically was an event that happened in 1916, and it concerned Henry Ford, the car maker. Henry Ford, the car maker, he may have invented like the modern machine production, you know, the what's it called? But there was another side to him. It's interesting this. I hadn't realised this. In 1916, he made a decision that he wasn't going to pay a dividend to his shareholders. He wasn't going to give his shareholders their annual payment. Instead, he wanted to divert money to his customers. He wanted to reward his customers. He thought his customers needed some reward. I think it was to do with reducing the price of the cars or whatever. But he made a conscious decision not to give the usual handout to the shareholders, but actually to reward his customers. And one of his major shareholders objected to this and took him to court. And the court ruled in favour of the shareholder. And basically the court said that however good were Henry Ford's intentions, he had no right to give away money that belonged to the shareholders. And from this point on, corporations were legally required to act in the best interests of the shareholders, not for the general good. So it was the interests of the shareholders that mattered, not the general good. And this has various consequences, and I'm just going to tell you what I wrote in the book, because I think David Loy's description of what this means is very good. He said, a corporation, so he's talking about how the fact that the corporation is an individual. He said, a corporation cannot laugh or cry. It cannot enjoy the world or suffer with it. It is unable to feel sorry for what it has done. It may occasionally apologize, but that is public relations. Most important, a corporation cannot love. Love is realizing our interconnectedness with others and living our concern for their well-being. Love is not an emotion, but an engagement with others that includes responsibility for them, a responsibility that transcends our individual self-interest. He goes on, corporations therefore cannot experience love or act according to it, and any chief executive officer of a corporation who tries to subordinate their company's profitability to their love for the world will lose their job, for they are not fulfilling their primary financial responsibility to the corporation's owners, the shareholders. So, I think that's really interesting, the way that he looks at love, concern, suffering, and so on. That we have created a set of individuals with enormous power. And we talk about how the individual who's following the Buddhist path can evolve in a progressive way, can overcome greed, hatred and delusion, and move towards generosity and loving kindness and wisdom. And we have created a legal entity that is incapable of evolving in that way. And we have given it enormous power. So this leads David Loy and others, and he works with others in America, to campaign for legal changes through the United States Congress to require corporate charters, the constitution of corporations, to be rewritten to include the necessity of social and ecological responsibility. That is not there at present. So that's his analysis of the corporation. And as I say, he's an activist. He was fascinated by the Occupy Wall Street movement, the Occupy movement, and a strong supporter of it. And he said, it's not enough for Buddhists to focus just on waking from their own individual dream. It's not enough for Buddhists to focus just on individual awakening. And he rhetorically asks, is it time to bring our spiritual practice out into the streets? So, that's David Loy, what I wanted to share about David Loy. So any questions on that before I go on to Bhikkhu Bodhi? I'd really recommend Money, Sex, War, Karma as a book. It's a tremendous book. Yep.
When he says it's only supposed to take our Buddhist practices into the streets, what does it actually mean in relation to corporations and things? Like,
He means that we need to be out on the streets campaigning, say, on climate change or whatever. We need to actually be out there with other people campaigning for social and economic change.
And not actually just being Buddhist in the street, but
being Buddhist. Well, no, you are out there as a Buddhist. So, like, for example, you know, there was the anti-austerity march on the 20th of June. And I was really pleased that a group of our Buddhists actually marched on that under a Buddhist banner. So when there was the climate change march in New York, was it earlier this year or last year? Huge, great march. There was a great big Buddhist section. So Buddhists out there saying, we care about these things, we want change. And that's great, because then Buddhists who are involved in these campaigns can come together, and it attracts people and it makes people think, what do Buddhists have to say about this? So it's visible. It's visible. And it can make such a big difference. You know, I mean, I discovered that there were people on that march who didn't know that there was a Buddhist section, because it was organised quite quickly. But what a great thing. And there was a Buddhist section when there was the anti-Iraq war movement on. There was a Buddhist section of that march, of the big march, wasn't there? And it's important to do things like that. Yeah. I think he is, in a way, yes. I mean, it's one of the ways. I mean, what you could say is that capitalism, well, in the book, at the beginning, I talk about how the Buddha recognises that we are driven by desire, in the same way that, like David Lloyd would say, we're driven by desire to cover up this sense of lack, which he calls tanha, thirst. And our job is to translate that thirst into something positive. So instead of, you know, recognizing that there is something missing, but you actually seek it through what he called the noble search rather than the ignoble search. So you seek it through a path of loving kindness, generosity, wisdom. But you could argue that what happened with the rise of capitalism is that certain conditions came together that allowed that ignoble form of tanha to really take off. To really take off in a way that it had not done before in the world. Because you look at everything that has changed in a very short period of time, 200 years, 300 years, massive economic and social change that's come about because of capitalism. That something seems to have produced a vehicle for the ignoble search, the ignoble form of tanha, of thirst, to really take off. So it's a manifestation, if you like, of what the Buddha was talking about.
Yeah.
Just to say that I think actually the terms capitalism and so on, well, it's a relatively recent phenomenon of 200 or 300 years, but it's a current term, isn't it? It's very interesting that since 2007, 2008, the last economic crisis, people talk much more easily using the words capitalism and what's wrong with capitalism. Before that, people were shy about talking about that, but not anymore. Did you want to ask something?
Well, no, I was just thinking, one of the things that strikes me, I've been thinking about this for a long time, is that if greed, hatred and delusion have become institutionalised, which is David Lloyd's argument, and it's very compelling, then is individual liberation even an option?
This is what Bhikkhu Bodhi talks about.
Oh,
exactly.
Sorry.
No, so it's very good, because that exactly is, well, in a way, this is what, not quite like that, but it's something close.
You know, because in a way, how does an individual fight against an institutionalised poison?
Yeah.
In a sense, so I feel that that's when a Tri Ratna, something Tri Ratna can offer, is the fact that we do, on whatever level, network and have a sort of sense of community.
Yes.
However diffuse that is for some people and whatever. And I think we could strengthen that.
Yeah. Good.
I'm just wondering if there's another side to the story.
Go on.
And that is, so you're talking about capitalism kind of institutionalising and reinforcing the ignoble, but has it not also done the other side? You could argue the opposite, couldn't you? That it's allowed more freedom, more education, more leisure time to pursue the spiritual life.
Yes. Yes.
Et cetera, et cetera.
No, you're dead right.
More healthcare, we live longer, we live healthier.
Yeah.
Well, we do in this country.
Yeah.
But I think,
That's an interesting point, because one of the things that really struck me was this issue of the institutionalisation and the corporation. And a lot of the benefits that came from capitalism came from owner, the enlightened Victorian owner who chose to give money for good causes, which a corporation couldn't.
Yeah.
And I was never struck by that before you talk about that. You know, like Cadbury's, Quaker-owned family firms could choose to do what they wanted to do with their profits. They could build Bourneville. They could provide good things for their workforce.
Yeah.
Then they sold out to shareholders, and then it was just a corporation.
Yeah. Okay. Let me respond. I agree absolutely. And I think it's true that you actually look at the progress of the last 200 or 300 years, and there are tremendous positive benefits from capitalism. You know, like education, a reduction in child mortality, you name it. There are tremendous positive benefits from aspects of capitalism. And even Karl Marx recognised that. He said he was just incredibly struck by aspects of progress in people's lives and the creative energy of capitalism. And one of the problems that we face when we try to envisage how might the system evolve is how do we allow it to evolve in a way where we do not lose that creative energy, that we do not lose the positive benefits. But there's a downside to it as well. So it's, I suppose my argument is that the current form of capitalism that we have, the neoliberal form of capitalism, is trapping us more and more on the negative side and is not allowing the positive potential that is there in capitalism to develop to its fullest potential. And we need to help capitalism to find a way around that, to find a way to release that positive energy that's there and to diminish the power of the negative side of it.
Well, also the negative side of it being that it's at someone else's expense.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of taking resources from other countries and... so that you get more and more inequality, so that the benefits are experienced by fewer and fewer people.
And that's one of the big problems. How do you overcome inequality? Because it's interesting you're mentioning like the Victorian capitalists. I mean, you know, like Birmingham was very much concerned, not just Bourneville, but just the whole sort of fabric of Birmingham in terms of the town hall and all this, that and the other. The grand vision of these people that wanted to put something back. And some of the most interesting socialists also came out of that kind of world. William Morris and others. They weren't poor people. They came out of that kind of world. And that's not a lot. You don't, well, I suppose you get your Bill Gates, who's got such a huge fortune and he is putting some of it back and so on, but it's nothing like that local level beneficial capitalism, if you like, that did exist. Okay. As usual, I've completely underestimated the time. I was talking with Vajratara and Vajragupta, and I thought I'll be through David Loy and Bhikkhu Bodhi within 30 minutes tomorrow morning. So I want to say a bit about Bhikkhu Bodhi. I'm wondering if we could take an early tea break now and carry on after the tea break. Is that okay with you two?
Yeah, great.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's have 10 or 15 minutes and then we'll talk about Bhikkhu Bodhi. So, Bhikkhu Bodhi. So basically, my my knowledge of Bhikkhu Bodhi was of a man who was tirelessly dedicated to the rigorous translation and elucidation of the meaning of the Pali Canon. So wherever you go in Sri Ratna, you'll come across these libraries that where there's the collections of the Majjhima Nikaya, not the Digha Nikaya, because that's a different person, and Gutra Nikaya, Samyutta Nikaya, and so on, all translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi, you know, the top translator of the Pali Canon in the world today. But more recently, I've become aware that he has another side. In the 1960s, when he was a student in the United States, because he's American, he was a political activist. And he was very active in the anti-Vietnam War movement in the United States. But he also became interested in Buddhism. And he reached a point where he felt he had to make a decision about which path he was going to follow. The path of political activism or the Buddhist path. And he thought that in the long run he could better help the world by becoming a Buddhist and a monk. That was the choice that he made. So apart from a 5-year spell back in the United States, Bhikkhu Bodhi spent 30 years between 1972 and 2002 living in Sri Lanka as a Theravadin monk. So for 30 years he lived in Sri Lanka as a Theravadin monk. And during this time, he worked with various other translators, including Jnanaponika Thera and others, and he became himself one of the top translators of the Pali Canon, and he became a respected Dharma teacher. And in 1984, he became the editor of the Buddhist Publication Society, and in 1988, he became its president. So he's deeply rooted in knowledge of the Buddha's teachings. This has been his life, translating the Pali Canon and being a teacher of the Dharma. But after having this long period where he was very much separated from the outside world, one of his teachers, I think it was Jnanaponika Thera, encouraged him to start to engage again with the outside world. So it was very simple. It was like reading Time magazine, other things like that, just beginning to engage in a way that he hadn't done, to get him thinking again about world events. And Bhikkhu Bodhi says, the social progressive that had gone into deep hibernation decades earlier was starting to reawaken. So this is still whilst he was in Sri Lanka. He felt this reawakening of his social activism, of being a social progressive. But it was his return in 2002 to the United States that shifted things dramatically. He's not well. He suffers from severe headaches, which nobody can find the cause of. So it was for health reasons, I think, primarily, that he returned to the United States. He's lived since 2002 in a Chinese Mahayana monastery. So there you have this leading Theravadin monk living in a Chinese Mahayana monastery, which I think is really good. I think he's the director of studies or some other title they've given him there. And it was that return that led him to fully re-engage with what was happening in the world. So he's able, you know, in the United States, he's obviously much more aware of media and so on, what's happening and what have you. And at the same time, because he's back in the United States and he's travelling and teaching, he was able to closely observe, in his words, how Buddhism was being assimilated in the United States. How Buddhism was being assimilated in the United States. And he was troubled and is troubled by what he saw as a complacent and self-absorbed attitude among many American Buddhists. He thought that they had attitudes that were disconnected from the deepening economic, social and ecological crisis in the world. And it seemed to him that many middle-class American Buddhists understood suffering mostly in terms of their own individual problems. So he said they were concerned with what he describes as the ennui of material prosperity. Wish I could have that. The ennui of material prosperity. The stress of unfulfilling relationships and discontent with their personal foibles. In other words, personalization, individualization of Buddhism.
Can you repeat this?
Yeah, okay. So this is his words. The ennui of material prosperity. The ennui of material prosperity. The stress of unfulfilling relationships. And discontent with their personal foibles. So, and what he observed was that outside a small group of engaged Buddhists in the United States, many Buddhists seemed barely aware of the misery that overwhelmed what Bhikkhu Bodhi thought was 90% of the world's population. So it'd be misery that's overwhelming people because of poverty, because of tyrannical regimes, because of social oppression, because of militarism, and because of economic globalization. And he was critical of the way that Buddhist practice was narrowly understood in terms of one's personal meditation, which appeared to serve largely as a therapeutic function. This is strong words. Strong words. And I came across these words after coming across the words that actually partly prompted me to write the book, which was the words of the Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek, when he said that he thought that Western Buddhism is the perfect ideological supplement to capitalism. Western Buddhism is the perfect ideological supplement to capitalism. What Žižek meant was, what he observed about Buddhists in the West was that they were concerned with their own personal meditation practice and were using it as a way to avoid engaging with suffering in the world. That they were making a conscious choice to withdraw into themselves instead of engaging with the world around them and the suffering in the world. And Bhikkhu Bodhi, in some ways, is much tougher in his criticism. So he thought that Buddhism, in his observation, was being taken up as a path to personal fulfillment rather than as a means of tackling the deepest roots of suffering, both for oneself and for others. So he's responded to this by writing about and talking about social and economic issues. And also, with the help of some of his students and Buddhist friends, he's founded something called Buddhist Global Relief. And the mission of Buddhist Global Relief is to combat chronic hunger and malnutrition. And now it runs over 50 hunger relief projects in countries such as Cambodia, Vietnam, Sri Lanka, India, Kenya, Niger, South Africa, Haiti, and the United States, or Haiti and the United States. So even in the United States, there's global relief projects. So he's doing something practical, and he's putting himself out there as a social activist. But what I find very interesting about Bhikkhu Bodhi is that this has led him to question some aspects of his understanding of Buddhism and what Buddhism is about. Now there he is, he's steeped in the Dharma of the Pali Canon, he's steeped in Theravadan Buddhism. So this is his thinking now. He says that Buddhism like many traditional forms of contemplative spirituality, is based on the perception of a disparity between involvement in the world and an exalted sphere of reality that is transcendent to the world. I'll just say that again. This is his words. A disparity between involvement in the everyday world and an exalted sphere of reality that is transcendent to the world. And the spiritual quest aims to ascend from a life that is normally dominated by impermanence, illusion, distress, anxiety, defilements of different kinds, to ascend from that to a spiritual realm in which these imperfections have been finally overcome. And this, that state is a state of enlightenment, which can be described as unconditioned, stable, pure, blissful and serene, a state from which we can never fall back into the swamp of unenlightened living. So this is his presentation of what, if you like, is a what Buddhism apparently stands for. Now, what he believes now is that this perspective is not wrong. This perspective on the human condition and its spiritual potential is necessary, but it's incomplete. It's not enough by itself. So it says it's necessary because it sharply illuminates the divide between the deluded condition of our everyday life and the state of ultimate perfection or enlightenment that is ever available to us. So we need that ideal of enlightenment to strive towards. It's necessary. Sharp illumination of that division is necessary. But it's incomplete because it can drive a wedge between the spiritual and the mundane everyday sphere of life. It can drive a wedge between the two. And as a result, we may feel compelled either to choose one above the other, to say, like he did in the 1960s, he chose the Buddhist transcendental path over a path of engagement with the world, the mundane. So he said, either we may feel compelled either to choose one above the other, or we settle for an uneasy tension between the ideal and the actual. That we settle for what he describes as an uneasy tension between the ideal and the actual. So that's the starting point for his analysis. His thinking starts there. And he goes on. He now distinguishes three major domains in which human life participates. So one he calls the transcendent domain, which is the sphere of aspiration for classic contemplative spirituality. You know, the transcendent domain, the one I've just been describing, aiming for enlightenment. The second domain he calls the social domain. And that includes our interpersonal relations, as well as our political, social and economic institutions. So there's a social domain that includes interpersonal relations and as well as our political, social and economic institutions. And the third domain is the natural domain, which includes our physical bodies, other sentient beings, and the natural environment. So he's describing three domains in which human life participates: the transcendent, the social, and the natural. Now he concludes now that a spirituality that privileges the transcendent and devalues the social and natural domains, or even sees them at best as stepping stones to realization, is not enough in our current situation, and may even help to put the future of humanity at risk. I'll just say that again. He's basically saying a spirituality that privileges the transcendent and devalues the social and natural domains is not enough in our current situation and may even help to put the future of our planet at risk. And basically he describes a situation which where the pursuits of contemplative spirituality are undertaken by what he calls the spiritual virtuosos, the contemplatives, the mystics, the yogis. So they go off and they pursue contemplative spirituality, the spiritual virtuosos. They're the ones who aspire to transcend the world, and they express their compassion simply by guiding others to the heights they themselves have reached. So they have compassion, but they express it simply by guiding others to the heights they themselves have reached. And the danger in this is that humanity's future is then left solely in the hands of politicians, chief executive officers of corporations, and technical experts who are often driven by greed and narrow belief in the value of technology. So the spiritual virtuosos go off over here and they leave this big gap, and what happens is that humanity's future is left in the hands of politicians, corporate chief executive officers, and so on. And he also says that this division opens the door of our communal institutions to religious dogmatists and fundamentalists. So those who do engage with the everyday world through religious fundamentalism and dogmatism have, to some extent, an open door. So instead of this division of domains, what he envisages or imagines is a future that requires the creation of an integral type of spirituality that can bridge the three domains of human life. So he says, until now, the spiritual quest has primarily moved along an ascending track from the conditioned to the unconditioned, from mortality to the deathless. That's one way that we would express it in Buddhism. So there's this ascending movement, ascending track. And he says, what is required today is to complement this ascending spiritual movement with a descending movement, a gesture of love and grace that flows down from the heights of realization into the valleys of our ordinary lives. And he says that both this ascending movement and descending movement are necessary. And he goes further than that. He says that the scale of problems facing humanity at the present moment forces us to give special attention to the descending movement. So he's actually arguing for a shift in emphasis. And under the influence of love, he argues, this requires that in the social domain, we must strive for government that embodies justice, equity, and compassion. So he's saying we have to engage politically and economically. We have to strive for a government that embodies justice, equity, and compassion. It would be interesting to bring Bhikkhu Bodhi together, if it were possible, with Dr. Ambedkar, wouldn't it?
Well, actually, or Banti, because I can...
Yes, that's exactly what, yeah. Banti, in terms of, like, you know, Banti talking about the love mode and the power mode, and in the Ten Pillars talks there about how we might need have to use the power mode in terms of redistribution of wealth and income. Yeah. Go on, Parami.
Well, and also in the Three Jewels, Maybe you're going into that, but where Banti talks about the bodhicitta arising because of that tension between engagement with the world and withdrawal from the world, and that rather than trying to get away from that tension, sit with that tension and let it grow until you're big enough to encompass and label.
Expressed it very well. We were talking about this yesterday. Yeah.
Sorry about
No, not smart. I mean, no, you said what I haven't got down here, but that's a very good point, yeah.
And that's what I think that's the wonder and beauty of the Bodhisattva idea, and why it's what Paul needs.
Yes.
Why it's what, sorry?
Why it's what it's what the world needs.
The world needs.
Yes.
This is the Glasgow School of Buddhism. I'm with you,
pardon. Yeah.
Okay. So he talks, he argues that social and economic policies must be grounded in the conviction that all human beings are entitled to live in peace with sufficient access to food, water, medical care and housing and opportunity to fulfill their potential. So this is a Buddhist aim. Do that. And in the natural domain, Bhikkhu Bodhi urges us to look at the universe with wonder, awe, and reverence, to treat all other living beings with care and kindness, and to ensure that nature's capacity for self-regeneration is preserved. So he's talking about the three domains here, the social domain, the natural domain. And he believes firmly that there is much in the teachings of the Buddha on ethics, on communal harmony, on the duties of governments and kings that can assist in this project. And as Bhikkhu Bodhi says, the Buddha taught the Dharma on the basis of a far-reaching vision that pierced the depths of suffering in both its personal and collective dimensions. The Buddha always had this dual vision. And it's interesting that he says, yes, we can expect stiff resistance from those who profit by preserving and extending the status quo of our current economic system. But he does believe that Buddhists can make a real difference. And what does he urge? He urges the creation of Buddhist communities, both locally and globally, that express wisdom, care, and compassion. It's quite interesting that he, for me, it's sort of because I read quite a lot, and when you read some of the more thoughtful there's a lot of thoughtful American Buddhists, but some of them like Bhikkhu Bodhi, and I remember also Rita Gross, who's written a very good essay. And what they point to is the necessity of Sangha, something that we take for granted. You know, that actually building Sangha is a critical part. You know, it's Banti's idea, what is the purpose of the nucleus of the new society? All the things that we were talking about yesterday. It's in our bones, isn't it, as true right in the Buddhist, but it isn't in the bones of Buddhists in America and other places. It's the necessity of Sangha. And again, I think we underplay and don't realise what we have to offer sometimes. It's very interesting, you know, like you have Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's been on a particular journey, people like Rita Gross who've been on a particular journey through Tibetan and Mahayana Buddhism, and they're all coming towards the place that Banti and Sangharakshita has been for ages and ages, seeing the necessity of Sangha. And we have a lot to offer there. I don't know if you wanted to add anything on that, what Pari was talking about in terms of this tension between the... if you want.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, Pari sort of said it all. I think there's an interesting parallels to Sangharakshita's thought, actually, between Bhikkhu Bodhi and Sangharakshita's thought The other dimension I was thinking about was actually the centrality of going for refuge. And when Bhante talks about the centrality of going for refuge and the contexts of going for refuge, one of which is the social level, which, going back to what you were just saying about other Buddhist groups often leaving out the sort of Sangha level, that going for refuge needs to be expressed both within personal practice and in the social level, and in the and also what he calls the cosmic level, but, you know, in all beings, which is reflected in our duties of an order member to your own personal practice, to the creation of a community, and to the world itself. So I think there's parallels about that as well, seeing that your going for refuge takes place within contexts. And that will inevitably bring up certain tensions. So the tension between wanting the transcendent, wanting a real spiritual practice and sort of leave behind the world, and wanting to engage with the world and relieve suffering. And I think the greatness of Bhante's approach with that is not to make that easy, not to say it's one or the other. In a way, you do need both. Because if you just have the going off into the transcendent sort of realm, then, something is missing, like Bhikkhu Bodhi is saying, something is missing in it. And he calls it the danger of pseudo-spiritual aestheticism, where he says you become a more and more refined sense of self.
This is Bhante.
This is Bhante. This is in the Bi-Tendential and Value of Being seminar. So then you get into pseudo-spiritual asceticism, and the interesting thing in that seminar when he talks about it is someone said, well, surely that must lead somewhere. And he says, no, it leads nowhere at all. Except for a more refined self. And what he talks about is the necessity of working with others, working in the world. And that's also necessary, but it's also necessary to have a dimension of personal practice when you're leaving behind the world as well, because otherwise, as we've seen, you can get very overwhelmed and sort of lose the spiritual dimension or lose that transcendent perspective. So, you need both. And there's just loads of things. So then what he talks about is, he says, well, it's not about having your own experience. You know, it's not about going off into this transcendent world and having your own experience of enlightenment. He calls spiritual development, spiritual practice, work, growth and duty. That actually you've got to engage with your own spiritual practice, but also engage with the world and engage with others in all those contexts of going for refuge. So I think all those little things, it's like he set out loads of thoughts that we need to really, that we take for granted, but we could explore much, much more, I think.
Where is the work, growth and duty? Where can you find that?
Experience and non-experience, that talk. Enlightenment is experience and non-experience.
You can see it mythically in the life of the Buddha, can't you?
Yeah.
He went to the forest to meditate, to escape, as it were, but then he came back.
Yep. And Dr. Ambedkar's point about that was he walked. Mm. Like yes. Most of those enlightened beings would just wait for their disciples to come to them. But he got up and he walked to his previous friends.
Yes.
In the heat, in May. Quite a long journey.
And he always walked.
Yeah.
There's that talk by Bhante called The Buddha's Victory, isn't it?
Mm.
Where he talks about the different stages of the Buddha's journey to enlightenment and the things that he overcame.
Mm.
And then the very last one is the vision of lotuses and going to decide to teach the Dharma.
Mm.
He talks about it in terms of the Buddha overcame the Buddha.
Mm.
It's the greatest victory of all, I think he said.
Mm.
And he overcame spiritual individualism. And, yeah. Went back to the world.